What if everything you learned about the civil rights movement was designed to make you feel comfortable? Picture Rosa Parks as a tired seamstress who simply wanted to rest her feet. Martin Luther King Jr. delivering a dream that America promptly fulfilled, and a nation united in its march toward justice. This sanitized story appears everywhere, in textbooks, presidential speeches, even Snapchat filters. It's a national redemption arc where America confronted its demons and emerged victorious. But here's the uncomfortable truth. The movement we celebrate today was considered dangerous, disruptive, and deeply un-American by most people who lived through it. The real history isn't just more complex, it's a mirror reflecting our present failures. When politicians invoke Rosa Parks while dismantling voting rights, when media outlets condemn Black Lives Matter using the same language they once used against King, we're witnessing historical amnesia as political strategy. Presidential administrations have perfected the art of honoring civil rights heroes while undermining their vision. In 1997, Bill Clinton commemorated the Little Rock Nine, framing racism as merely an affair of the heart, a personal failing rather than structural violence. This happened shortly after he signed welfare reform and crime legislation that devastated Black communities. When Hurricane Katrina exposed America's racial fault lines in 2005, President Bush rushed to honor Rosa Parks, declaring Jim Crow safely buried in history. Barack Obama's election supercharged this narrative. Time magazine proclaimed King's dream fulfilled, while Obama positioned himself as the culmination of the movement's aspirations. His presidency became proof that America had overcome, evidence of exceptionalism rather than ongoing struggle. The physical memorialization of the movement reveals this sanitization most starkly. The Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial on the National Mall presents him without context, his quotes carefully selected to avoid words like racism, segregation, or inequality. Rosa Parks's Capitol statue depicts her as demure and passive, dedicated on the very day the Supreme Court heard arguments to gut the Voting Rights Act. Our civil rights narrative fixates on Selma and Birmingham, letting northern cities escape accountability. In February 1964, nearly 500,000 New York students and teachers boycotted schools to protest segregation, larger than the March on Washington, yet uncommemorated. By framing racism as a Southern pathology cured by federal legislation, Northern liberals supported civil rights elsewhere while maintaining segregation at home. The distinction between Southern de jure segregation by law and Northern de facto segregation by circumstance made Northern inequality seem accidental rather than engineered. Reverend Milton Gallimison led massive protests against New York school segregation. Black parents, excluded from official PTAs, formed independent organizations, challenging both bureaucratic resistance and deficit language describing their children as culturally deprived. Despite the massive 1964 boycott, a much smaller counter-protest of 10,000 white New Yorkers received sympathetic media coverage and influenced Congressman Emanuel Seller to insert a loophole in the Civil Rights Act, protecting northern segregated schools from federal enforcement. From his Birmingham jail, King identified the white moderate as a greater obstacle than the Klan, those claiming to support equality while opposing disruptive methods to achieve it. After World War II, social science provided cover for structural racism by emphasizing culture over systems, culminating in the 1965 Moynihan Report. Researchers studied alleged ghetto pathologies rather than policies creating segregation. Officials created programs targeting juvenile delinquency and job readiness rather than systemic racism, implementing harsher school discipline and increased policing. The 50th anniversary coverage of Newark and Detroit uprisings erased Northern activism from memory. Catherine Bigelow's Detroit depicted the police raid sparking the uprising without acknowledging years of organized movements documenting brutality and demanding housing desegregation. King and Parks had criticized this pattern. Northern officials condemned Southern injustice while rejecting local demands, then feigned shock when cities erupted. In 1964, white Californians passed Proposition 14, repealing fair housing laws, by 2-1 margins, while voting overwhelmingly for Lyndon Johnson. They wanted civil rights for the South, not their neighborhoods. 9 months later, when police beat Marquette Frye and his mother, the Watts uprising began. Governor Brown expressed shock, claiming California was a state without racial discrimination, ignoring years of documented activism. Northern newspapers actively impeded local racial justice struggles. They covered Southern activism righteously while dismissing local Black activists as demanding too much too fast. When activists organized the massive 1964 New York City school boycott, the Times condemned it as violent, illegal truancy. When 10,000 white New Yorkers marched defending segregated schools, the Times portrayed them sympathetically as preserving neighborhood schools. As King connected racism, war, and poverty, mainstream outlets grew more critical. After his assassination, Harry Belafonte told a Times reporter that the climate of hate and distortion created by mainstream papers contributed to King's death. Rosa Parks declared, "I was never just an integrationist." Yet sanitized history reduces the movement to seeking access, a bus seat, a lunch counter, rather than fundamental transformation. The actual vision sought to reorder America's social, political, and economic landscape. Criminal justice reform was central from the start. The Montgomery boycott emerged partly from Emmett Till's murderer's acquittal. Before boycotting, activists like Edie Nixon and Parks fought discriminatory policing and impunity for violence against Black citizens, seeking justice for Recy Taylor and Gertrude Perkins, Black women raped by white men who went unpunished. Economic justice was equally fundamental. The welfare rights movement emerged directly from civil rights activism, with Black women like Johnny Tillman forming the National Welfare Rights Organization. Through organizing, welfare access expanded dramatically. By 1971, over 90% of eligible families received aid, up from less than 33% in 1960. Leaders understood racial justice was inseparable from global justice. King condemned Vietnam as cruel manipulation of the poor and called America the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, earning harsh criticism for not staying in his lane. This expansive vision has been deliberately removed from public celebration, making the movement safely distant and irrelevant to contemporary struggles. Civil rights activism wasn't heroic in the moment. It was isolating and dangerous. Rosa Parks observed that such a good job of brainwashing was done on the Negro that a militant Negro was almost a freak of nature. She struggled for over a decade before the bus boycott, often despairing that no mass movement would emerge. Septima Clark lost her teaching job of nearly 40 years for refusing to renounce her NAICP membership. Her own family didn't support her. The vast majority of white Americans actively opposed the movement. A May 1961 Gallup survey found only 22% approved of the Freedom Riders. White religious leaders denounced King as anti-Christian. The FBI called him the most dangerous to the nation. The personal costs were devastating. The King's home was bombed. Parks lost her job and never found steady work in Montgomery again. Her husband suffered a nervous breakdown. Even after the boycott's success, the family received death threats and fled to Detroit, where they struggled financially for years. The most depoliticizing aspect of our civil rights fable is how it erases the organizing, making movements seem spontaneous rather than built through difficult collective work. The Montgomery bus boycott wasn't a sudden eruption, but the culmination of a decade of largely unsuccessful struggle by persistent NAACP activists. Multiple acts of bus resistance preceded Park's stand, building community outrage. 4 nights before, Parks attended a packed meeting about Emmett Till's murderers walking free. When the bus driver told her to move, she thought of Till and refused, coolly challenging the arresting officer, "Why do you push us around?" Parks wasn't quiet or passive. She transformed her anger into deliberate action. What sustained the 13-month boycott wasn't walking, but a massively organized carpool system, arranging 15,000 to 20,000 rides daily through 40 stations with 300 volunteer cars. women were foundational. Georgia Gilmore's Club from Nowhere and Inez Rix's Friendly Club raised crucial funds by selling food. The boycott used Black economic power to force change. White authorities responded with harassment, issuing hundreds of tickets to carpool drivers. Young lawyer Fred Gray filed Browder v. Gale with four women plaintiffs, and in June 1956, a federal court declared the segregation unconstitutional. This fuller history reveals that movements are built by groups combining economic disruption, legal strategy, community organizing, faith, and righteous anger. Meanwhile, politicians who actively oppose voting rights and police reform declare Parks their hero. The movement's icons have been weaponized against contemporary activists. Critics invoke King to delegitimize Black Lives Matter, claiming he would never block highways or disrupt order, conveniently forgetting that King did exactly that and was widely condemned for it. Today's struggles mirror the civil rights movement. Just as Parks wasn't the first to resist on buses, Michael Brown and Eric Garner weren't the first killed by police. Black Lives Matter echoes the Montgomery boycotts pattern, building on existing ties while creating new structures, facing similar white resistance strategies of deflection and criminalization. Across northern cities, established movements raised alarms about police violence and housing discrimination for years, only to be dismissed. When uprisings erupted, officials claimed surprise, framing them as inexplicable violence rather than predictable responses to sustained oppression. The sanitized fables we tell obscure uncomfortable truths. Parks admitted it was hard to keep going when all our efforts seemed in vain. Most Black Alabamians saw the NAACP as futile, yet activists persisted because someone had to do something. This history isn't about inevitable triumph, but about people who labored for decades in the wilderness, slurred, surveilled, and ignored. They combined organizing, economic pressure, legal strategy, and righteous anger pursuing comprehensive justice. This more terrible but beautiful history shows us who will lead today: ordinary people across America who pick up the burden of justice anew, knowing the work is long, the costs are real, and the victory is never final. Recognizing polite racism's tools, silence, coded language, bureaucratic obstruction, reveals their continuous deployment from the civil rights era to today. The moderate, more devoted to order than to justice, remains the primary obstacle to racial justice. The Times' 2015 coverage of New York school rezoning naturalized white opposition while ignoring Black and Latino organizing. The Globe's desegregation coverage focused on busing rather than underlying segregation and decades of Black activism preceding court orders. The media's role wasn't neutral documentation. It was active gatekeeping that legitimized white resistance while marginalizing Black demands. The movement's actual legacy, its comprehensive vision for economic justice, its sustained resistance to polite racism, its women-led organizing, has been carefully excised from our collective memory, leaving us with heroes we can worship without continuing their work. The question isn't whether history will vindicate us, it's whether we'll have the courage to act before vindication arrives.